trust that your representatives in Washington are working around the clock with the world's best scientists to protect you and your family from this terrible disease. When we band together, we are strong. Oh, he didn't write that? Oh, no, he wrote this. Low ratings, fake news, MSDNC, and CNN are doing everything possible to make the coronavirus spelled wrong look as bad as possible, including panicking markets if possible. Likewise, their incompetent do-nothing Democrat comrades are all talk, no action. USA in great shape. He's right. Why is the liberal media only focusing on the negative side of the coronavirus? It's so biased. This is all part of his if you can't spell it, you can't catch it campaign. He's especially worried about this, not just because of the stock market, which is key to his reelection, but also because he just realized how hard it will be to eat a bacon cheeseburger through a face mask.
Because the White House's messaging has been all over the place this week. In fact, on Tuesday, the very same day that the CDC said that the spread of coronavirus in the United States was not a question of if, but when, one of Trump's top advisors was on TV saying this.
We have contained this. We have contained this. I won't say airtight, but pretty close to airtight.
Well, which is it? Because airtight versus close to airtight is a pretty crucial distinction. It's the difference between having a working submarine and a cool metal tube to die in. And the dissonance there speaks to a real problem, because in a global health emergency, you want to hear from the many trained experts who we're lucky enough to have working in our nation's public health agencies. You do not want to hear from politicians. And yet, on Wednesday, the president had a surprise announcement.
President Trump, alongside his top health advisors, sought to calm a nervous nation, naming a new point person to lead the administration's response.
I'm going to be putting our Vice President Mike Pence in charge, but he's got a certain talent for this.
Does he? Does he, though? Because I was under the impression the only things Pence had a certain talent for were avoiding off-leash women, sucking up to people who represent the antithesis of everything he claims to believe in, and miserably failing at pulling off a haircut known as the Judi Dench. But putting aside Pence's, to put it mildly, extremely mixed record as governor of Indiana on managing public health issues, even the announcement that he would be leading the task force was a debacle. Because Alex Azar, the Secretary of Health and Human Services, was already supposed to be chairing that task force, and Trump didn't seem interested in clarifying their roles, or indeed, really being there at all.
Wish him good luck.
Who? Secretary Azar, given Pence
move. I think if I
could just clarify, I think you're not getting the point here of this. I'm still chairman of the task force.
You don't feel like you're being replaced.
Not in the least. When this was mentioned to me, I said I was delighted that I get to have the vice president helping me this way. Delighted. Absolutely.
Yeah. He just left. This was a press conference meant to calm the nation. And with the most basic question of who would be running things seemingly up in the air, he just f***ed right off. And look, I know we're used to only seeing businessman Trump, but it is nice to occasionally get a glimpse of the absentee father in him too. More than just a lack of leadership, it is also concerning that Trump's main focus when discussing this virus seems to be downplaying any potentially bad news. He started this week tweeting, "The coronavirus is very much under control." But there was no way to be sure of that, as he frankly should have known. Many of the test kits the CDC initially developed to detect the virus apparently didn't work as expected, meaning that as recently as Wednesday, the CDC and only 6 state labs were testing for the virus. Thankfully, that has since been fixed, and we're presumably going to find more cases now. But Trump seemed reluctant to admit that that will happen. In fact, you can watch that dynamic in real time as officials at the press conference say one thing, and he tries to massage it into something else.
We can expect to see more cases in the United States.
We do expect more cases.
When you have 15 people, and the 15 within a couple of days is going to be down to close to zero, that's a pretty good job we've done.
Yeah, but it won't be close to zero, will it? Your experts just said cases will go up, and you said they will go down. You can't just ignore real numbers and make up ones that you like better. This is the problem with a president whose entire life has been a series of low-stakes lies. A man who has lied about, among other things, his net worth, His apprentice ratings, the number of floors in Trump Tower, the size of Electoral College victory, the attendance at his rallies, whether it rained at his inaugural, and even whether or not he was invited on this very boring and low-rated show. Which he wasn't. He wasn't. It was a lie. But there is a difference between lying about something that means literally nothing and lying about the spread of a deadly disease.
Don't bother to wash your hands. Gay marriage is a sham. The virus has a reason, and it's all part of God's plan. No test vaccines on Reese's. Put your faith in Dr. Jesus. We will understand the virus.
So on Saturday, Trump tried to defend his handling of the crisis, and in doing so, he once again lied about the speed of his government's response.
Since the early stages of the foreign outbreak, my administration has taken the most aggressive action in modern history to confront the spread of this disease. We moved very early. Experts now agree that the decision to move so quickly, despite a lot of opposition on that decision, was a wise one. It greatly slowed the spread of the virus to the United States.
No, you didn't move quickly. For one thing, you never move quickly. You lumber around the White House lawn in circles like an only child on an Easter egg hunt by himself. Second, there's new evidence suggesting the virus may have been spreading for weeks, a problem worsened in part by the fact that we haven't had widespread national testing, which would make sense because when reports of the outbreak first began to make news around the world, this is how the president responded.
The virus. They're working hard. Looks like by April, you know, in theory, when it gets a little warmer, it miraculously goes away. I hope that's true.
The coronavirus, that's a new thing that a lot of people are talking about. Hopefully it won't be as bad as some people think it could be. And we think it's going to have a very good ending for us.
Hopefully it's all going to be great.
Maybe there's something new, because for 2 days, I haven't been seeing too much of that news.
Now, the virus that we're talking about having to do, you know, a lot of people think that goes away in April with the heat, as the heat comes in. Typically, that will go away in April. We're in great shape, though.
Where did you get this idea that it just goes away in April? Are you confusing it with Lent? You know, it starts in February, and it usually goes away in April, but you have to give something up to avoid catching it. I'm giving up flag humping. And yet, of course, somehow the president is not even the dumbest Donald Trump to weigh in on this story, because in case you forgot, there's a second Donald Trump, and he had this truly disgusting thing to say on Friday.
Anything that they can use to try to hurt Trump, they will. For them to try to take a pandemic and seemingly hope that it comes here and kills millions of people so that they could end Donald Trump's streak of winning is a new level of sickness.
Jesus, someone is desperately trying to get their father to love them. I'm doing this so my father will hug and kiss me like that goddamn flag. I'm sorry I don't have stars and stripes, Dad! Sorry! This is the kind of crisis management situation where you want competent, apolitical people in charge. Instead, we have an administration that would rather spend its time raising money, meeting with the actors in a right-wing play, and cuddling with American flags. All we can do for now is stay calm and listen to the advice of healthcare professionals, and as for the Trump administration, just hope that
it's going to disappear. One day it's like a miracle, it will disappear.
When you put your arms around me, I get a fever that's so hard to bear. You give me fever. When you kiss me, fever. When you hold me tight, fever. In the morning, a fever all through the night.
Fears of coronavirus are running high, and Donald Trump has been encouraging government employees to stay home by firing them for disloyalty. In fact, in the wake of Trump's impeachment acquittal, the White House has created lists of disloyal officials.
I'm making a list, checking it twice. Gonna fire you, then eat a cake slice.
So, to handle the list,
Schumer sent me cheesecake today.
So, to handle the list, Trump recently promoted his personal aide, John McEntee, and instructed him to purge the executive branch of anyone not loyal to Trump. A purge! That sounds like the Soviet Union. Instead of red square, it's orange blob. Now, to help him purge the disloyal, McEntee promptly hired James Bacon, a 23-year-old college senior.
You had me at bacon.
Now. A college senior. Clearly, as long as you're blindly loyal, Trump doesn't care about age or experience. And here is tell us more about the administration's new hiring and firing policy is White House Management Director Kayla McKenzie. Thank you so much for joining us, Kayla.
Thank you for having me, Stephen.
So, Kayla.
Director McKenzie.
My apologies, Director McKenzie. What do you actually do there at the White House?
My job is to cull the weak, Stephen.
Really? Okay, how old are you?
How dare you ask a woman her age? What else should I expect from fake news CBS? You're just as bad as the Never Trumpers at Nick Jr.
We're ordering a lot of different elements of medical. As you know, they're working as rapidly as they can on a vaccine for the future. And with that, I think I can head out.
You think you can head out? I'm not sure, because you didn't tell us anything. He said, we're ordering different elements of medical, which I guarantee you he thinks is fire, earth, wind, and water. And now scientists estimate that the mortality rate from the coronavirus is around 2%, which sounds pretty bad. But honestly, if you had given me only a 2% chance of dying during Trump's first term, I would have taken that in a heartbeat.
It is a leap year, as I said. Leap year began in the year 45 B.C. under Julius Caesar. This is true. He started the leap year in order to correct the calendar, and we still do it to this day. Another thing that happened under Julius Caesar was he was such a powerful maniac that all the senators grabbed knives and they stabbed him to death. That'd be an interesting thing if we brought that back now. I asked my lawyer if I could make that joke, and he said, let me call another lawyer, and that lawyer said yes.
This week from the
Puppet Regime, Mudhoney, Peggy, Armstrong,
the Magnetic
Fields, Golden Earring,
thanks to
Rod Serling, Rudy Giuliani, Richard Nixon, Seth Meyers, Trevor Noah,
Jimmy
Kimmel, Beck Bennett, Keenan Thompson, Colin Jost, Sean Hannity,
Rush
Limbaugh,
John
Oliver,
Larry
Kudlow,
the
Sean
Donald Trump
Jr.
and
Mulaney.
preceding show was recorded at Wave Farms WGXC in the Hudson Valley in New York State.
Now we're joined by Meg Nowak from Historic Catskill, which is a new organization that Meg, I guess you'll tell us about too.
Good morning. Yes, thank you, Tom. So again, I'm Meg Nowak, and I cultivate Catskill. Historic Catskill is actually an offshoot of Cultivate Catskill, which is an organization that's been around for about 7 years, and it's a we do the flowers, the flower baskets, the pocket parks here. So we're into
beautification. You've got the flower baskets on the
Uncle Sam bridge. Yeah, and they're getting more. There's more. They're breeding. There's more and more. And pretty soon we're going to cover that bridge with flowers.
When does that start? Because there's not flowers out there right now.
Not right now. No, it's a little chilly to do that. But I think we're, of course, gearing up to do that. We have a good volunteer group that gets all the flowers together, orders the flowers. So they're already ordered. So we're gearing up. But of course, we can't put them out until there's, you know, no frost,
well,
no chance
last
of frost.
2 days. I don't think it got below 32 last night.
It did not. It's going to be another beautiful day today. But we can't get too excited because then you just, you know, it's ruinous.
I think this weekend it's going to come back and bite us a little.
I think so. So no flowers yet, but be prepared. And the parks will be full of flowers as well. Our pocket parks on Main Street, as well as the trees. So Cultivate Catskill takes care of the street trees as well. So it's a great organization, and there was a strong need for more awareness of historic preservation in Catskill. And so the founder and president, Shelley Pulver, asked that we sort of do an offshoot, as I said, of Cultivate Catskill. And that naturally sort of became Historic Catskill. So we're going to try to be a lobbying group and a group that helps people with grants or tax incentives for their historic buildings. And Catskill has a very large historic district, and it's nationally recognized.
Where is the
east side, so does not include the west side of the creek, but east side, it goes all the way to the Hudson, basically from Catskill Creek to the Hudson, and there is a little tiny street called River Road down towards the point, and it ends there, and then it ends sort of in a strange, weird way up by the Thomas Cole House. So the Cole House is included, but then, well, if you saw the boundaries, you'd get such a laugh because they're very sort of gerrymandering. But it's, you know, there's chance for expansion. But it contains 552 houses, structures, including historic Main Street. So it really is, it's a big one. It's an early one. It was established. The document for the nomination was written in 1979, and it was established in 1982. So it's a good solid historic district. And within that district, I'm just going to go for this, is the historic jail complex. And this is kind of what I wanted to talk about on air today. And thank you again for allowing me to do this. Is I'm giving a program at the Bridge Street Theater, so that's 44 West Bridge, right across. You know, it is on the west side, Historic Theater.
But not technically in the historic district.
No, it's not. The theater itself is not. But wait for it. We're gonna get that west side. Ah. We're gonna get a west side historic district. Just mark my words. I won't.
In time for the Storts demolition?
No, sadly, it takes a long time to get a historic district up and running, but. But I will be giving that presentation this Saturday, so that's March 7th at 4 p.m. And I did put together a little reception, so there will be some goodies and some drinks afterwards. But my main goal is to focus on the history, the story of the complex, because I wish that people would go by and look at it. It's a rectangle. I'm not including the 1978 edition. That is very unattractive and very poorly built, as I understand. But the rectangle that is the sheriff's office, which faces on Bridge Street. Its address is 80 Bridge Street, right behind the courthouse, and then the actual cell block, which is right behind that in a line, and then the carriage house, which is right behind the cell block. These buildings were built in tandem with the courthouse, so it makes a, you know, they laid the cornerstone for the courthouse in 1908, and they were completed and in use in 1910. And the stories and the build, I have construction photographs, and it is really a neat building. People made a lot of effort to build it. The architect was fully involved. And it makes an interesting story. And then there's the whole gangster. I've discovered so much information about Legs Diamond, and I will be discussing him too.
He spent some time there?
His cronies spent quite a bit of time, but as you know or may know, he was very elusive and very difficult. He's very crafty, difficult to pin down, shot many, many times, and always survived, except, of course, the last episode. But whatever the case, I do have a photograph of him being escorted up the stairs to the jail. So he did, I'm sure he brushed up against those cells. He may have been held in one of them, but whatever the case, that alone, it's not a glamorous story, and it certainly is a terrifying story, but it's all part of it. But I'll be discussing that, too. In addition to unfortunately, the buildings are slated for demolition this year. It is in the historic district. It is contributing to the historic district because it does face a major intersection. It does belong to a grouping. The courthouse, the library, which was built in 1901, so just a little bit before that, all the banks, like Little Wall Street, those were all built almost the same time. So in preservation world, it creates a very, very cohesive group of buildings that were built. You know, the village was evolving at that time. There was money, and the courthouse at the time and the jail.
For Catskill, that seems like the biggest change I can ever think of in a couple years' time.
Yeah.
That whole intersection was different.
You know what? It was, in the sense that there have been investors. The two buildings right on the, you know, across from the courthouse, the bank building, that's been purchased and will be part of a hotel that Mr. Katz.
I meant back in 1900 to 1915.
Yes, of course. It was a huge change. I'm so sorry.
I mean, it's changing now, too, and we'll get to that, but I'm still back in the past.
Yeah, as you should be, and I like to be back in the past, too. But it definitely was. And it is part of the evolution of the village. And these are buildings, you know, people come to Catskill as tourists, and historically they came to because of the mountains and the mountain house and the Catterskill Hotel. And, you know, that's a whole other subject. But it, you know, historically Catskill has always been a tourist destination. And people come to see historic buildings. It is our greatest asset. It is, you know, we've got the mountains, we've got the backdrop, we've got the views, but people come to see this beautiful village. And if we have more gaps and more holes and more parking lots, which is what the county plans for that site, is a parking lot. So
just from a real estate point of view, it seems kind of crazy to use that kind of use in such a valuable place.
Yes, and it is. It is a very prominent spot. It's a prominent intersection. I believe, from what I understand, it's court parking, so the village can't use it. You know, residents can't use it until maybe after 5 or at all. So
in the future, if they put it in,
correct.
Nobody's going to be able to park there except the judges and the lawyers.
Yeah. So that's not beneficial. You know, that really, in addition to which, a parking lot, it gives no joy. It absolutely has no, there's no joy in a parking lot. It gives no jobs. There is no economic benefit to
skateboarding after 5 p.m. is the only joy I can think of in a parking there, lot.
Oh, you're so positive. Yeah, no.
That's the only thing I can think
you
of.
You are an optimist. Your glass is definitely half full. But and so is mine. I mean, I really, I have hope for these buildings nonetheless. And because they're good, strong buildings, they've been neglected, there's been deferred maintenance, and yet they still stand, and they still stand.
Is it a done deal now? The village passed a resolution
to
support the county?
They did. Well, basically,
it's the county's decision, right?
The county owns the site, and so ultimately it is their decision. Of course it is. I mean, there, you know, there's no denying that. However, we could have used a little more force and been a little more visionary in the use of the buildings, because they could be a real economic boost. We have a few restaurants, and I, you know, frankly, I did have an investor, and I still do, who's interested in putting a hotel and a restaurant and the jail bar, where I think it would be the most incredible draw from, you know, for people all over in all counties. And because this is, jails are hot stuff. And in Europe, in Philadelphia, in Boston, they have repurposed old jails to be bars and restaurants, and they are full, and they're bringing people to these cities and to these neighborhoods. And to sort of abandon that is just not.
And if there was a bar brawl, then you could take them right next to the court.
You know what? Just shove them out the door. See? You're thinking very positive again. No bar brawls. But whatever, you know, whatever the case. The court system is also interested in the site, which would make a lot of sense, the proximity to the courthouse. So, and they would reuse the buildings, and they have stated this, but unfortunately that went on fell on deaf ears. But
do they need something like that because of the jail moving up to Coxsackie? Is there like a holding situation that needs?
No, you know that I am not absolutely certain, but I know the court system, they may even need, I know they need judges' chambers, they need family court space, they need public defender space, and they may.
So they're saying the courthouse isn't big enough.
Correct. Yeah, because some people are spread. Yeah.
So you're saying already there's offices in other places?
Yes. Yeah. That's correct. Yeah. So
then that's a good argument that they do need space.
Yeah. Yeah. It is. But whatever the case, I just want to go back to my talk on Saturday, because I'm excited about it. I think these buildings need a little, you know, they need a little shot in the arm. They're very special, and a lot of people have filtered through there. I'm not talking about inmates. I'm talking about sheriffs and their families who lived in the sheriff's office. That was their home. And so, you know, I have historic photographs of the sheriff and his extended family, including a baby in a baby buggy with Christmas trees all over that porch. And it's just very charming and very touching. And just to ignore that is just heartless. I mean, to ignore the people that built it, the people that live there, and it's just not, it's not good form.
Are you looking if people come out on Saturday, if they have old pictures or movies of
that
space?
Oh, that would be fantastic. It is a rare thing to find photographs of the jail because, you know, it's not necessarily a tourist attraction. But people, you know, I have found some very, very nice photographs at the Vetter Research Library, for example. And then the historian Michael Rausch, the Coxsackie historian, has come forward with these three construction photos that are just fantastic, and that I'll use in my presentation. So if anyone does have stories or information on the jail, I will collect it and put it in my files, because I think it's really important to document the not only the structure but also the human element. That's what makes it. So, you know, I don't know. I get very emotional about it. It keeps me up at night. But I do hope everyone please come, because it's going to be fun, despite its, you know, sort of the dire need for this, these buildings to remain. But on March 7th, Saturday, 4 p.m. at the Bridge Street Theater, I hope everyone comes out and supports this worthy cause.
Is there a website people can go to?
There's a Facebook page. It's Historic Catskill. I'm not on Facebook, so I don't really know.
If you search Facebook for Historic Catskill, you'll get
yes.
to it right away.
Yeah, and it has the event on that page, and you can do whatever you do on Facebook. So yeah, I would encourage you to do that. But we're getting there. We don't have a website for Historic Catskill yet.
All right, but if people are interested in getting involved, they can stop by. Again, it's 4 p.m. Saturday?
That's correct. Yep.
At the Bridge Street Theater down on West Bridge Street.
Yep, 44. right? 44, all those
across
fours.
From the juice bar.
Across from, yep, that's exactly right. That's right. Okay, thank you, Tom.
Thank you for joining us today.
You're very welcome.
Sharon Jones of Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings, and you're tuned to WGXC 90.7 FM Accra.
Participating in WGXC's Tower of Babel Pledge Drive. The Tower of Babel is a biblical myth about turning one voice or one language into many. That's what WGXC's Radio Tower does. WGXC recently renewed its tower lease to continue FM transmissions on 90.7 FM. We need your help to keep that tower full of the many voices of the Upper Hudson Valley. To keep local children on the air, to keep the radio full of a broad spectrum of voices. Please go to WGXC.org/donate and do your part to keep many voices, many perspectives on WGXC 90.7 FM, community radio for Greene and Columbia counties. And thanks to Nancy Barber, Bill Stone, Christian Swenningson, anonymous listener from Kinderhook, Michael Morey of Cairo, Matthew O'Neill of Phoenicia, Anna Maria from Hudson, and so many more people who have already become sustaining donors to WGXC or have given a huge chunk of change for their one-time donation. It's up to you how you want to do it at 518-697-7400, online at wgxc.org/donate, and you are more than welcome to mail it to us, WGXC Care of Wave Farm, P.O. Box 13, Acre, New York, 12405.
WGXC underwriting support is provided by Hilo Catskill, cafe, bar, art gallery, and performance space located at 365 Main Street, Catskill, New York. Wavefarm's WGXC is pleased to broadcast live from Hilo every Tuesday morning starting at 9 a.m. In addition, Hilo live events are streamed and broadcast in conjunction with the Wavefarm Radio Transmit Partner Program.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Carol Friedman of Hudson, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a sustaining supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and designating an amount of your choosing. Thank you for your support.
You're listening to Transmission Arts programming on WGXC 90.7 FM.
Make your choice, Medicare or coronavirus for all.
I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan and our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. My coworkers make impossible choices daily because a lot of us don't have access to affordable health insurance. Those are the words of Vladimir Clerjean, a passenger service representative at JFK Airport in New York City. He was speaking at a training session Wednesday, learning to deal with the coronavirus COVID-19 epidemic. He said, "We choose not to see a doctor for a health problem because it could be the difference between paying the rent, taking care of family, or getting needed care." Earlier in the day, Vice President Mike Pence met with airline executives to discuss the crisis. Air traffic is still safe, they concluded. Yet it was reported on the same day that one of the growing number of coronavirus cases in Los Angeles County was a medical screener at Los Angeles International Airport. It wasn't clear if the illness was contracted at work or not. One thing remains certain. The coronavirus doesn't care how wealthy you are or what political party you're in. The best way to be sure the person next to you isn't sick is to make health care available to everyone. The best way to achieve that is through Medicare for All. The popular Medicare program, instituted in 1965, provides no-cost medical care for those 65 and older. Medicare for All would simply drop the eligibility age from 65 to zero, covering all Americans from birth. Our current health care system of private and nonprofit hospitals and doctor's offices would remain in place. Payments, however, would be made by the U.S. government, the single payer, replacing the for-profit health insurance corporations, which would essentially be put out of business. In presidential candidate, now Senator Bernie Sanders' Medicare for All bill, taxes would go up on the middle class and the wealthy, but onerous insurance premiums, deductibles, co-pays, and out-of-work expenses would go away. Health care costs would go down more than taxes would go up, except for the very wealthy. Most of Medicare for All's costs would be covered by eliminating the bloated overhead, profit-taking, and multi-million-dollar executive salaries of the health insurance industry. More savings would come from negotiating lower prescription drug prices, which Medicare is currently prevented from doing by law. Additional costs to society would be lowered or eliminated, such as the expenses incurred by millions of uninsured people who resort to emergency room visits that could have been avoided with preventive care and annual doctor visits. As the coronavirus pandemic spreads, it's in every individual's interest to know that all people have access to preventive and diagnostic care, as well as treatment if needed. You don't want to come down with COVID-19 because a person you were next to in some public setting couldn't afford a deductible or copay, didn't have paid sick leave, or is among the 37 million in the United States who completely lack health insurance. Last Monday, New York Governor Andrew Cuomo issued a directive requiring New York health insurers to waive cost sharing for coronavirus tests and related emergency room, urgent care, and office visits for those who already have insurance. He said, "Containing this virus depends on us having the facts about who has it," he said. He went on, "These measures will break down any barriers that could prevent New Yorkers from getting tested," unquote.
I'm going to amend the paid sick leave bill that I sent to the legislature to add a specific provision that says people who, because of this situation with coronavirus, have to be quarantined, should be protected. Their employer should pay them for the period of quarantine, and their job should be protected.
But what about those who are uninsured? On Wednesday afternoon, Vice President Pence gave a press briefing flanked by senior public health officials. At Monday's briefing, Pence pledged daily updates and full transparency. At Tuesday's briefing, the White House inexplicably banned video and audio recording. At the end of Wednesday's briefing, as Pence exited and with cameras once again allowed, a reporter asked about what happens to the uninsured. Katie Waldman Miller, Pence's press secretary, said, "Scream into the camera, it ain't going to get you anywhere. Listen carefully."
Can the uninsured get tested? Gentlemen, ladies, can the uninsured get tested?
Scream into the camera, it ain't going to get you anywhere.
Well, how about answering the question?
We would like an answer.
That's a valid question. Could you answer it?
The question was ignored. Pence's press secretary, Katie Waldman Miller, married Trump's anti-immigrant senior advisor, Stephen Miller, 3 weeks ago. At New York City's major airports, workers like Vladimir Clergeon are represented by SEIU 32BJ. Wheelchair attendants, security cleaners, and passenger service representatives are demanding state government action to improve their health care plans, which currently make health care unaffordable with high premiums and deductibles, the union said. This is New York State Senator Alessandra Biaggi, who's just introduced the Healthy Terminals Act into the state legislature.
The Healthy Terminals Act is an attempt to really make sure that the people who are on the front lines of international travel at our airports, JFK, LaGuardia, Stewart Airport, have protection. During the Ebola crisis, these airport workers were only given a paper mask. We know that that is almost ridiculous because a paper mask will not prevent someone from getting Ebola. Here you have the security workers, the baggage workers, the wheelchair attendants, and the food and retail workers in our airports, the people who are doing the back-breaking work to make sure that our airports function and work are not protected under any insurance plan.
In 2018, President Trump disbanded the White House's pandemic response team and slashed the Centers for Disease Control funds for assisting other countries, including China, with epidemic prevention. We need a robust public health infrastructure. Above all, a healthy populace with regular access to affordable health care is the best defense against an epidemic like we now face. Medicare for All would give our national health care system a much-needed shot in the arm. I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
Yeah, for some reason or another, you sound a little taller on radio.
All right, we're now here with Jack Mab from you're the Columbia County Public Health Director. Is that your title?
Yes, I am.
First, can you give me the basics? The COVID-19, is that the name, or coronavirus? It's a type of coronavirus, just like the common cold is a type of coronavirus.
Yes,
is that?
And I think that's important for people to understand. You know, coronaviruses have been around forever, and we're constantly exposed to them. And they do give us the cold. And this started out, they were using the word novel in front of it because it's new. It's a new it's a new version of a coronavirus. And coronaviruses do change with time. And, you know, they do assail us and we get sick from them. But this is brand new. It doesn't appear that you acquire an immunity after having it. And that's another thing.
So you can re-get it again.
You can get it. That's what the CDC is telling us. That's possible.
So take me through the steps. Last week I had a head cold. It was a pretty bad head cold. It only seemed to be, I had congestion and some headaches, fever, not really fever. I probably didn't have the coronavirus.
Yeah, I don't think you had a coronavirus.
So how can people tell if, because there's plenty of colds and flus going around this year, it's been a particularly bad flu year, how can you tell what the difference is?
Well, the only way you're going to tell is by testing. The symptoms of the coronavirus is pretty much identical to the flu. The critical thing for the CDC so far has been the fever. 83% of the individuals who are positive for the coronavirus have a fever, spike of fever, and they have the travel history.
I've read some anecdotal reports of people saying they had it, and talked about sweating a lot, and we saw the Iranian prime minister or whatever was sweating, and then 2 days later he got. Is that a symptom that's not being talked about as much?
We have not really seen it as a symptom. I mean, if you have a fever,
you'd be sweating. So fever, it's just associated with the fever.
Yeah, it's associated with the fever.
So if people think for some reason that they have it, what should they do? What locally do you call Columbia Memorial? Do you go to urgent care? What is the best practice?
Well, if you have a provider, then I would certainly contact your provider. Columbia Memorial, the testing for it requires a swab from the lower part of the respiratory system. So this is not at this point, this is not something that can be tested for at the health department nor in a typical provider's office. You would end up at the hospital to be tested. What the hospital is looking for, the hospital has a protocol in place. They have negative pressure rooms that people end up in if there's a suspect case. They should call us. If someone thinks that they meet the criteria, they have a travel history.
You should call the
health department.
And what's the number to call?
828-3358. And they should call the health department because the hospital wants to know ahead of time if somebody's coming in. And the best way for that to happen is for us to coordinate it.
And has the hospital has the hospital started doing tests yet here in Columbia County?
The hospital hasn't tested anyone as of yet. And again, what we don't know is a little unclear at this point. We did have our vice president say last night that anybody who wants to be tested should be tested. At the same time, there's still this criteria from the CDC that holds sway over everything, and that is you have a fever and a travel history. They've obviously expanded it beyond China to cover some of the other countries that is endemic in now. But you have to get approval to get tested. And that could very well change in the next couple of days.
The governor is saying they're trying to get up to 1,000 tests a day, and so far they've been getting like under 100 tests a day in the state, I think, right?
Right, and I think that's because they're still using the protocol, fever and a travel history, or contact with someone who's already positive.
So the state has the ability to do more tests, but the standards right now are not to do so many tests.
Not to do so many tests, correct. And I think that what I listened to the governor's press conference, and he said, I would like to be able to do up to 1,000, and I think that he certainly wants to test everybody who thinks that they're appropriate to be tested and everybody who meets the criteria.
Is it already a problem, or are you concerned that it's going to be a problem in the future that more people are going to want tests and think they're sick and you're going to be kind of overwhelmed with requests that aren't really that pertinent?
Well, there's been a tick up for us in terms of people calling saying, should I be tested for this? I traveled or I didn't travel. We had a gentleman yesterday who said I spent 2 weeks in the Bronx. Well, that's not a foreign country that we're worried about right now, but he nonetheless had a pretty heavy cold or the flu. So, I think it's not a problem. I think that as the word gets out there that the testing may expand the criteria, I think more people are going to want to get tested.
Are you going to need more staff in your office as this ramps up and as there's cases in Columbia County of the actual virus?
Well, I don't think we're going to need more staff, again, because if we're going to be sort of the focal point for presenting to the hospital, I think the hospital could.
The hospital issues. Will need more staff.
They have four negative pressure rooms up there. That's where people who have an infectious disease would naturally be put in. And if there is a dramatic increase in the criteria, a dramatic change in the criteria where many more people are testable, it could be a problem for the hospital.
Are you coordinating preparation with the hospital?
The hospital has its own. They have their own plan. That's already been in place. And we've always had these plans in place for pandemic flu. And so we're really looking at this as the same.
You went through sort of in 2014, there was the, was it MERS then?
We had MERS, and which is much more lethal virus out there. And we've had SARS in the past and H1N1 that, was sort of a pandemic that wasn't back, I'm not sure of the date on that, but so
you've got to this preparation point before, but you're starting to get to a new land where you've never been before, where it's happening locally.
Well, we've always had the plan in place for pandemic flu, and that just addresses a lot of social distancing and non-pharmaceutical interventions that we can do, and the plan is applicable here. What we have here is a coronavirus that may be a little bit a successful virus, as the doctor I spoke to earlier today suggests. It's a successful virus. It's moved into 73 countries.
The main difference is that it's a little more lethal and it's a little more successful at spreading?
It's a little bit more lethal if you look at the numbers. I don't necessarily always trust the numbers coming out of China. I mean, the biggest number of cases still remains China. And so when you look and when you do the math on it, flu is less than 1% lethal. And this, the WHO has it at 3.4%. CDC did 2.something%.
The same with the Iranian numbers don't make sense either. There's way more fatalities than there are cases reported, and that there's probably some lag or misinformation there.
I think so, and I think if it may settle out closer to the 2%, but 2% is a whole lot more than the flu is, and by way of comparison, MERS was 4% fatality. So, it's a little bit more potent than the flu. The flu on steroids, one doctor quoted in an interview that I was watching. But nonetheless, 80% of the population is going to get it and may not have symptoms at all. that's one of the things that concerns me, people walking around who are positive who don't have symptoms because they go about their business.
But they're going to be spreading the illness to people that are susceptible
to it.
They
could very well be because we don't know what the incubation period is. It's a brand new thing. We don't know what the incubation period is.
But there's nothing you can do about that because they don't know that they have it and there's no way to tell. So,
and or if they even have, you know, minor symptoms or symptoms that, that you would equate with a cold like you had, they may go about their business. And they go about their business and they may in fact be positive.
So there's no, it's almost inevitable that 80% of the country is going to have this by the time the next year rolls around?
No, I don't think so. And I asked that question several times of our infectious control doctor, and he said, you know, there's no way of predicting this. And he in fact said, I thought this would be over. Didn't think it would get out of China. I thought it would be over before March 1st. And he said, this is a successful virus, but I can't predict that it would. And he said, there's also talk about the warm weather and the effect on coronaviruses in warm weather here. And they don't do well in warm weather. But
then 1918, they went away in warm weather, and then in October it came back and killed a couple hundred thousand people, right?
Right. And also, it's warm weather for us. It's not warm weather for Australia and the Southern Hemisphere, and it's already there, too. So it could easily spread within that country, become pretty much endemic, and then once our flu season starts, once the cold weather happens again here, it could come back. It's just not all that predictable.
But that's probably why there's very few cases in South America right now, and it's because it's summer there.
Right.
So what is it that people – do you recommend people should do? Should you change anything you're doing in your normal life? What are you recommending for people in Columbia County to
wash
what actions
hands,
they can take?
Wash your hands. I think it's keep your hands away from your face, but I think it's really about mitigation, personal mitigation on this part. If you become ill, certainly if you have a travel history, if you've just gotten back from someplace that has the virus in place and you become ill, talk to your provider.
So Westchester County now is one of those places.
Yeah, so like another nation, right? And again, the concern there is that he was taking public transportation and attending public events, and so in the coming days, it's going to be interesting to see what happens with that. But I think you have to take the same precautions that you would take with the flu. Wash your hands,
because they haven't proved any sort of transmission except for touching your face or being sneezed upon by someone else?
Droplets is if you get sneezed upon. Airborne is just being in the same space with somebody who has it. And the CDC is now saying maybe it's airborne.
They don't know exactly, but it could possibly be airborne, so that if you're just in the same room with someone.
Yeah.
And so there's nothing not touching your face isn't going to help you in that situation.
Right. Or surface. And what we also don't know is how long this particular virus lasts on surfaces. So, well, somebody with the virus who's positive is walking down an aisle in a supermarket and sneezes without covering themselves. There's droplets in the air. There's a mist that comes out. Well, if it's airborne and you walk through that mist an hour later, you might acquire the virus because of that. It's possible, but we don't know.
So we have a public place here, a radio station with lots of people coming in and out. Other people have stores or shops, nonprofit organizations. So here at the radio station, should we be rubbing everything down with rubbing alcohol alcohol content to every day? Because isn't that what they're doing in the subways now? Or
I think they're doing that on some of the mass transit. And you know, certainly, you know, I would go back and say, do what you do for the flu. If you had a guest that came in here and who was really clearly sick and didn't want to stay home and still wanted to do the interview with you, then I would wipe everything down after they left, for sure. And I would wash my hands. But, you know, going about, it may be here. It may be, you know, somewhere in the county with an individual here. We have the third busiest Amtrak station here right in Hudson, people coming back and forth or whatever like that. It could come into the county or it might not. And I think the precautions you should take are those that you take for the flu.
And so local shelves have already been cleared of masks. I think canned food, people said, were starting to be rarely seen. And is there anything that people should buy now ahead of it landing in Columbia County or anything you recommend? Because the masks don't really work, right?
The masks don't work. What most folks in the business would say is the mask protects other people from your germs. So if certainly if you are if you feel you're infectious, you know, what does your doctor do? There's a sign up when you go to see your doctor. If you have symptoms of the flu, please wear a mask. They're not there to try to protect you from them. They want you to protect them from you. So if you have the flu or if you have flu-like symptoms and you're going to go out, you know, wear a mask for the safety of the rest of the public. But the masks don't work to protect.
But mostly you should stay home if you got sick.
If you're sick, if
at all possible. But is there nothing else you recommend to purchase or prepare at home?
Well, I think most people, you know, have a certain amount of food in their house that, you know, lasts 3 days. It's wintertime if we get a snowstorm or whatever like that. But, no, we're you know, certainly I wouldn't stockpile Purell. I guess you can't really get it now.
Right, that's another thing.
On the internet, yeah. I guess it's, what, $140 a gallon or something like that, which is ridiculous. I don't think you should stockpile anything right now. And, again, this thing could just sort of die out as a warmer weather comes or not.
If it gets worse here, what is the situation? I mean, are people going to be told to stay in their houses potentially, or is it going to be mandatory you have to stay in your houses?
I don't think it'll ever rise to that level. But, you know, one of the things that we've been contacted by the schools, for instance, in the county, the school is a mass gathering place, if you will. Churches are a mass gathering place.
And a mass gathering place for germs, because right. A lot of the people in schools aren't so good about not touching their faces or touching surfaces.
And sneezing into their elbows.
Right.
I mean, they just let it go. So we've been contacted by the schools, and just to get some preliminary information about, you know, what happens if, you know, a significant number of children are out, what if a significant number of staff are out and whatever like that. And that's the kind of planning that they should do anyways. And, you know, we've had schools that closed because of the flu in the past. You know, of course, in Westchester County, they closed a couple of schools just because of the coronavirus.
I think an Albany County school, like 2 weeks ago, closed on a Friday because so many students were out with the flu. So it's not that strange.
It happens.
But you don't foresee it there being some sort of China-like lockdown where everyone is, I don't know if it's mandatory there, but you've seen the scenes on TV of no one on the street.
No, I don't foresee it. You know, again, if this was Ebola, I mean, Ebola had a 50% death rate once you got it. Again, this is something that the individuals who are most seriously affected by it are the elderly. This is like the flu, the elderly and people with comorbidities. And so I don't see this mandatory lockdown, you know, everybody off the streets kind of thing. And I don't see us necessarily ever in the future telling any school that they should shut down. It's going to maybe be a conversation about maybe it's a good idea to do that and just to get that break in there and go through and clean it.
It seems like almost all the deaths have been either someone who is very old or in some sort of respiratory condition to begin with.
Yeah, that's pretty much accurate. And the interesting thing is today we read an article that it's really not affecting children.
That's what I've read. I was going to ask my next question. Yes, the young people are really not. So the schools may not be as much of a vector for this particular strain as other strains, since we all know how schools are vectors for colds and flus.
Well, and to some degree, there's a certain immunity that comes from just being exposed to that giant amount of coronaviruses, different coronaviruses that come into their lives. They readily spread it to each other. So,
Is there anything else that you want to tell the public about this, or something they should do, or that they need to know about this?
Well, I think it's a time where they just need to pay heightened attention to what's going on, because this situation is so fluid. We do get phone calls from people who say, well, I'm going to go to Bermuda next week. Should I go? I'm going to France in May. Should I go? I think that's a positive thing. They're thinking about it. They're paying attention. But I can't tell that person who's going to France in May, don't go or go, because I don't know what France is going to be like in 2 months. So I think that people need to pay attention to that. They need to pay attention to, especially with New York City, and we now have some cases down there, you know, what happens with those numbers. They pay attention to that. And at the same time, practice those basic steps of washing their hands and, you know, avoiding individuals who are sick, or staying home if you're sick.
And it's all right to eat Chinese food and drink Corona beers, right? Because there's been polls that say like 30% of the country doesn't want to drink Corona beer.
I did hear that. I think that's crazy. And there's we've had a few phone calls from people who said, can I receive packages from China?
Right.
It doesn't live. We know that the virus doesn't live that long on the surface, on a dry surface.
So the only way you could catch it is from someone being in the room with you or leaving behind something